You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Liz Rosenfeld. She's an artist that's living and working in Berlin. Liz, thanks so much for being with us today.
Hi, thank you.
Let's talk about your work in the broadest sense, but I'd like to begin with what you're doing right now, what you're working on, or your current project is.
Well, actually, I just finished working on a film trilogy that I've been making for the last 4.5 years, which is most of the time. Well, I've lived in Berlin for 7 years, so I've been working on it for the last 4.5 years, and it is a trilogy that marks the rise and fall of the Weimar period through the kind of perspective of female artists that were living in Berlin during that time. But actually, my interest was more kind of in the way that history transcends itself and how, in many ways, the people in my community and friends who are here, who I live and work with, are in many ways present-day versions of these artists, or who kind of carry these specifically queer perspectives of art and history in their own work. So that's what these films are looking at specifically.
Okay, so but these films are making a parallel to queer history and queer theory, or they're talking about specific people in the Weimar period.
No, go on.
I'm just curious whether those people, maybe you can give examples of some of the people the film profiles as it relates or parallels your community.
Well, I was specifically looking at so the artists that I look at are Frida Kahlo, Anita Berber, Hannah Hawk, and then the final film, which takes place in 1933, which is the last year of the Weimar Republic, is through the perspective of the home movies of Leni Riefenstahl. And I was interested specifically in choosing Leni Riefenstahl because I wanted to sort of think about who she was before we knew her as Leni Riefenstahl, and also specifically what kind of films would she have made before we knew her as not just creating, Nazi propaganda, but actually changing filmic history through the way that she made these incredibly complicated fascistic images. And so I thought, well, what would be sort of the exact opposite of that, which is, and also quite a personal perspective, which would be home movies. And I suppose when I say that, so the other side of it was that I was very interested in the way that queer history travels and how history is really anachronistic as opposed to kind of factual, particularly queer history, which for me and for many people I think is very much told through perspective and story. And so I wanted to kind of take these figures that we know through stories in art history and look at them as, young people, mythical people, and in many ways think about how the people that I'm surrounded by right now and inspired by and who I work with may in fact also again be, thought of potentially in the future as these mythical kind of, maybe not mythical, but how our history as queers and artists would potentially be carried through. So I also am really interested in film genre, and each film is playing with different genres of film. So the first one is shot like a film from the 1920s, and it's very fictionalized, kind of hypothetical, romantic. Frida Kahlo, when she's 19, before she even really had an inkling of herself as an artist, actually, and Anita Berber, who was a very famous artist during the Weimar era in Berlin, and there are a lot of stories about her, a lot of stories about kind of also different personas that she played, who she was to people in different ways, and I thought a lot about that in terms of transient bodies and in many ways like a trans, not just specifically transgendered, but a transient trans identity that I think queer figures in history hold. And the second film is about the artist Hannah Hawke, who was one of the only female Dadaists in the Berlin Dadaist group in the 20s, and it was also the time in her life that she was in a lesbian relationship, quite a well-known one. And she also was one of the only Dadaists that did not leave Berlin when the Nazis came into power. In fact, she just moved to the outskirts of Berlin and stayed really quiet. And as a result, she actually was one of the people that restored a lot of the early Berlin Dadaist work that is now archived. So I was really interested in her in terms of who she became actually after the Weimar period. And the middle film, which is called Hawk, is a fake interview that I wrote of her in the early 70s, the year before she dies, and it's shot like a kind of PBS documentary style film, and it's basically about her her really talking about the uselessness of nostalgia and also looking at the 70s youth culture of Berlin at that time and how the you know, kind of imagery of Weimar was coming back as this radical notion in youth culture, and then also very much in today in queer culture, which is where this all started for me, was kind of why is queer performance and queer art, what is this, you know, one side of it was like 1970s feminism, and then a lot of it as well was sort of this like reenactment of the Weimar age. So that's actually also where this interest for me started, was how is nostalgia a useful tool for history making, or is it actually?
That's fascinating. It sounds really interesting. Now the question I have is about Leni Riefenstahl. She was she gay, queer? What's her role there? I mean, I can think of parallels, but no, right?
Actually, and I should really, I'm glad you asked that, because I also, when I use the word queer, I don't specifically mean in terms of sexuality. I think in terms of queered bodies that are somehow outside of a systemic way of, you know, producing culture. And, I mean, Leni Riefenstahl for me and the other figure in that film, in the home movies, is her and Eva Braun, and I put them together not because I wanted to propose that they had like a lesbian affair at all. It's actually not about sexuality in this way at all, but I was interested in these two women who were, you know, the most well-known women in the Third Reich. I don't actually even know what kind of relationship they had to each other, but when I started doing research about them, I wanted to really understand, you know, who they were before they were, you know, two of the most famous Nazis, and also specifically because they were women. And they actually had a lot in common. They both had really, like, dreams of becoming, well, in fact, Leni Riefenstahl had quite a career as a film actress in Germany and also kind of in Hollywood, but just as her Hollywood career was about to take off, she decided to stay. She was so moved by a speech that she heard Hitler deliver before he was in power that she decided to stay and actually, you know, support the future of National Socialism. And Eva Braun is actually a really interesting figure, and I think in history has really been portrayed as this kind of weak, you know, housewife who only lived for Hitler, but in fact she had great visions and a lot of passion about filmmaking. And the only reason that there is, in fact, any home footage of the Nazis at all is because Eva Braun was this, like, avid home movie maker. And so I wanted to somehow bring these two women together, you know, before they became Leni Riefenstahl and Eva Braun, and sort of also propose, because the it ends with the final film, which is called Die Neue Frau, and it really ends with this sense of impending doom, but not even so much in terms of what history is about to produce, but in terms of how these women's lives are really going to change, and kind of in many ways an intimacy is being destroyed in their lives. And what that film does is it really just follows them like on a day together, going to the park, having a picnic, being at home, being silly. But also what happens, and in fact what really happens through these three films that I find links them, is that the people who are all, you know, quote unquote playing these characters, it really, these characters actually are very much abandoned and it becomes the people themselves. And that's quite important to me as well, because everybody who is each of these women in my films are also artists who are living and working in present-day Berlin and have different, very strong connections to these artists in history. So that also becomes a really important part of what's going on in the films as well.
That's fascinating. How long are each of these films?
They're 20 minutes each, so the whole trilogy is an hour.
And is it complete, or what stage is it in now?
It's complete now, actually. We just finished it about a month ago, and I don't have any official screenings yet. I'm still just sending it out and showing it to people and, yeah, finding kind of the right place to show it for the first time.
Well, it sounds fascinating. And Leni Riefenstahl certainly is, you know, and such an unusual and kind of extraordinary figure. I mean, I've been fascinated by her for a while and saw that film, The Wonderful Horrible Life of Leni Riefenstahl.
Yes,
which I didn't like too much, but I feel like she's an example of how, even though she's been vilified as this Nazi and making propaganda, I think it's something of a testament to the power of art that it's undeniable that she's one of the more extraordinary filmmakers of all time. I mean, she did amazing things.
Yeah.
And it's such a hard thing to kind of justify this kind of person who's viewed as, was a Nazi and a sympathizer and also an incredible artist. I think it speaks something to the power of art to even transcend all that. And now she's, for a while, I think her selling her work in New York was impossible, but it started happening, I think about 10 or 15 years ago and seems to be going over without a, so let's talk a little bit about maybe earlier work, but I'd also like to ask, how is this funded? This sounds like a huge project. Do you have a lot of support for this?
Well, this was very much a community-oriented project, actually. I came to Berlin 7 years ago not knowing a soul. In fact, it was just a really big life change for me, partly because I have family history here and I was interested. I actually thought I was going to end up making a film about well, my mother had just passed away, and my grandparents were German Jews that I had grown up with. My grandmother was from Berlin, and I really came back here with this idea that I was going to, like, somehow, you know, find out something or have some big insight about my own Jewish diaspora. But really what happened was I sort of found a queer diaspora in a way that I had never found before. And it was very much through this community of artists that I fell into. I joined basically how this all started was that I had this idea for the first film, Frida and Anita, and I had just met the two people who I am now collaborators with and have a film collective called Now Moment Now, which has been going also for the last 6 years, Imogen Heath and Sam Icklow. And we met, and they just said, you know what, let's just make this film. We had the equipment we needed between the friends that we knew. We had a small fundraiser at a bar to raise enough money to, have a film set. We shot in all of the local places in our neighborhood, like the bar that we go to every night and my bedroom and the graveyard down the street. It was really very DIY in this sense, but what was just amazing was the way that it really galvanized so many people to come together, which I found to be just so special to Berlin, actually. I will never forget the first day that we shot the Frida and Anita. Just people heard that we were looking for help on a film set and showed up, and that's how we had extras and an art department, and ended up being one of the biggest crews I ever worked with, actually. I think there were like 50 people on set. And at the time, it was totally volunteer. And then for the second film, Hawk, it was also low budget. We were shooting it in my bedroom as if it was, you know, a house Hannah Hawk was visiting for the day. And in fact, the actress who was going to play Hannah Hawk pulled out an hour before we were shooting. And so we called all of the people we know, and I just said, you know what, we're just going to have six different people play Hannah Hawk, and they're just going to visibly read from this script. I also directed the Hannah Hawk film in German, which was, especially at that time, my German was not, it's still not great, but it was not at all, I was not a good German speaker, but I had this script that I got translated, and actually something really interesting happened because we have such an international group of friends here that, people were reading German with all these different accents from this script, and kind of this like very interesting pastiche of like perspective happened. And then that took on a whole other element of the historical, theory of this, film as well. And then the third one we did a Kickstarter for because it's all shot on 16 millimeter film and we hand processed it ourselves. But again, like, it really wasn't, we didn't need to raise a lot of money, but it was a lot of, you know, volunteer and free labor, which is something that we do a lot here in Berlin. And I don't want to say free labor because, in fact, this is a conversation we have a lot right now, but, you know, in the wake of a very, very weak art economy, especially as grants are getting harder and harder to get, in particular for work that is not, you know, mainstream or like part of an art market, we've really kind of been forced to create this economy of trade labor where we work for each other, which is actually what our film collective Now Moment Now has very much become in ways, is it's three filmmakers who support each other in our work, but we also help to produce the work of other filmmakers. And also we've gotten, you know, paid work through that. Like, we've done a lot of music videos in the last few years as well. It's been a really interesting time to be an independent artist, actually, particularly here in Berlin, because it feels, at least for me, in the group and community that I've been working in, I really can't, obviously I can't speak for everybody, but it really feels like we have each other, and everybody just wants to see each other, you know, do well and create this. And we are now really talking about how do we make this kind of labor recognized as not, you know, free DIY labor, but actually its own sort of economy.
And so part of how you survive is by working for other filmmakers or other jobs?
Well, now, actually, really in the last year, the way that I survive, I'm also a performer, and which is the other half of my practice as an artist, and I work with, I've been doing a lot of different kind of collaborations with performers here, in particular dancers, actually. I think that since contemporary dance has been moving more and more into this interdisciplinary kind of space, people who are not trained dancers have really begun to be embraced by that scene. So I've made a lot of videos for dance pieces. I've also, or for theater pieces here, and I've also been in quite a few ensemble pieces where we created the work together. And all of that is funded through art grants in Berlin. And also artist residencies, and I do some teaching as well. So little things, I kind of, keep myself going through different kind of jobs in the arts. But it took a while to get there.
And where were you before you came to Berlin?
I was living in New York. I had just finished my master's degree in performance studies at NYU. And then I took a year and just worked in at a nonprofit and really had my goal set on moving to Berlin, actually. And then before that, I had done an MFA at the Art Institute of Chicago in film and performance, which is where I really started my film work. And at that time, I was really, and also was, I've always been really invested in ideas of history. And at that time, I was very interested in kind of the all of the reenactment work, particularly in relationship to 1970s feminist art, which was starting to really kind of have this resurgence. This was about, I don't know, more than 10 years ago now. And my thesis when I was at the Art Institute of Chicago was a remake of Barbara Hammer's film Dyke Tactics from 1974. And I actually got a lot of really a wonderful response with that. And also at the time, Barbara was really starting to, her work was starting to be re-embraced as well by the art world. So that was a really wonderful coincidence. And it was great because this piece that I had made, which was, again, the original Dyke Tactics was a film that Barbara Hammer made in 1974, where she got a group of her friends to go into the woods, women, and she filmed them, you know, doing all of these rituals together. And she also, it's said that she was one of the first women filmmakers to film a lesbian sex scene that was not specifically porn. And as a result, her film, Dyke Tactics, was actually a tool that was used in the lesbian separatist movement, not actually by her specifically, but by lesbian separatist activists, and it became this quite iconic kind of document of that time. And so I was really interested in sort of thinking about, when I was in grad school at the Art Institute of Chicago, well, what would a queer version of this look like? I mean, in almost the sense of, like, what is, you know, queer propaganda? What is, what would this document look like today? And so I kind of did this opposite in the sense that I got a group of my friends together and I brought them to, like, this concrete car park, kind of abandoned car park in Chicago. And I just improvised with them and did similar things that Barbara did and asked them to just kind of like relate and be intimate. And, you know, many of them were like genderqueer people. And also at the time, it felt like gender and transgender issues and queer discourse was really it was something that was new, at least for me and for the people that I was spending my time with. And so that film for me is also very much this kind of like document of a moment of like emergence of different bodies and language that was happening amongst us at that time, and also an homage to Barbara as well, very much so.
And so your transition to Berlin sounds kind of wonderful. I'm curious, as an American and in New York, and knowing that Berlin, you know, has been talked about as this kind of new art center, in the way you've already said it. But how do you feel about the whole art world and the art community in Berlin as compared to New York and Chicago and everything you've experienced there?
Well, it's hard for me to talk about it in terms of kind of an art world, because I do have to say that I think that I only know a very certain facet of it, which is the facet that supports me and that I support. And I think that there are so many different kinds of art worlds in Berlin. But what I was really, when I left New York, I have to say, I felt really discouraged and kind of jaded. And I felt as though there was a certain kind of game or a certain kind of language that I couldn't figure out. And it was actually, it created a great depression for me, and I stopped making work for about 5 years. And also, I think just the experience of surviving and living in New York City is so counterproductive to also being a productive artist unless you have a situation that supports you in that full time. But like I said, I really actually didn't come here with any expectation of having a full-time life as an artist. I just sort of thought, okay, like I need to find something else, and I need to actually find a place in which I can make things again.
And you found that. I mean, Berlin,
yeah,
to me, it
absolutely.
Sounds like you're describing it, a more affordable place in terms of, I mean, I think New York's wonderful, but Berlin sounds like a very welcoming place, embracing of you, your art, and a community. Seemed like it was created fairly quickly that you entered into without knowing anybody. And in New York, that's not an easy thing to replicate, that kind of community you're talking about.
I mean, I think that also Berlin, for me specifically in my experience, creates a different sort of time-space continuum where, you know, certainly, like, you need to work to survive. I also just have to say I've been incredibly lucky because I was eligible to apply for dual citizenship as a result of my grandparents' history here, being German Jews who left after 1933. And it's one of the only situations, really, that a European country allows somebody to have dual citizenship. And that was something that I also realize now more than ever is a great privilege, particularly in this economic time. But so that really, really helped me a lot. And it also made it easier for me to work in different countries and to take work without having to worry about a visa situation, which so many people I know do. And really, while I was, you know, I survived doing whatever I could, but, you know, I didn't have to have this kind of full-time life that you have to have in New York City, or at least when I lived there, I had to have. I could organize my life where, you know, I could work, you know, at a bar or a cafe, or, I mean, I've done a million different jobs in this town. I was actually just talking about this morning, that it's kind of amazing. Part of an amazing experience is all of the different things I've done to survive for money until art started to really support me. But I think that something else I really realized about Berlin is, and I don't know if this is true in other cities, but for me, and for many people I know, committing to living here is so important to ultimately being an artist that is being supported and surviving in this city just from culture. And that's something that took a long time to build, but as a result was so worth it. And I mean, I don't want to, you know, make it sound all romantic and easy, because it's certainly not. I mean, you still have to, you know, work very hard and like I said, do what you have to do. But at the same time, it isn't a city where there's something about, there's a slowness here that is such a privilege, actually, that also as a New Yorker, I just had to get so used to. It took me a long time to get used to this slowness. And then you realize that it's a gift, and that slowness provides you space in order to really. And it's really, it is a gift. It is a privilege, and you decide what to do with it. And I think that for some people, it's hard, but I feel very lucky to have experienced that in my life, actually.
Liz, thanks so much for talking with us today. I really appreciate you.
Thank you. It was great. Thanks so much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIVC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.